Sonoma State College has sponsored for the second year a media research effort aimed at identifying those news stories which have been kept off coverage from the establishment media or which receive very little coverage. This year, the top most censored story of 1977 was the myth of black progress. Some of the other stories are, oh, the acid rains that are destroying crops, the rage to exploit mineral deposits in the ocean floor, exploitation of illegal aliens by American employers. By contrast, the most important news stories chosen by the American newspaper editors were the Mideast conflict, the death of Elvis Presley, last year's severe winter, and Burt Lance's resignation. So much for the values of the establishment media. We'll talk just about most anything on our program. Alternative Views News Magazine.
Good evening. Welcome to Alternative Views. Tonight we're going to have an in-depth focus on Vietnam, Cambodia, and China to give an analysis and have a discussion of the momentous events that are going on in this communist sector of Asia. Our guest tonight will be Chris Cunningham, who of the University Y, who visited Vietnam last May, and will talk about her experiences in that country, and we can discuss with her some of the issues of the Vietnam-Cambodian War. Our other guest will be Professor Ed Rhodes of the History Department at the University of Texas, who's a coordinator of the Texas China Council, and will discuss with us what are some of the events now going on in China and what, if any, changes have been taking place in recent years in China's foreign policy. We'll begin tonight, however, with the Newswatch. Frank, what stories do you have?
Well, I have a continuation of the one we started out with, the most censored news stories. The curious thing about it is the original story, which was given to me by one of our UT librarians, who's very helpful, came from the Chronicle of Higher Education, in which they had the 10 best censored news stories listed. However, one of them was missing. And that one we found when they showed me High Times magazine. The one that was missing was President Carter's association with the Trilateral Commission. Isn't that curious? And speaking of President Carter and the Trilateral Commission, Jack, you've been following Carter and presenting a lot of reports on Carter and the Democrats, the new Congress, the midterm convention and all. How about a rundown on the his performance and the State of the Union? Did you count the lies?
Well, I don't know about lies, but the basics of the Carter budget have been known for months. They were leaked in late October, and we here on Alternative Views have done our best to bring you a blow-by-blow description of the assault on social services and what looks like the New World Economic Order that's been architected by President Carter out of his affiliation with the Trilateral Commission and other sundry associations. For the most part, there will be no new initiatives coming out from the White House or the Congress. We last week talked about the makeup of the new Congress and said that it's very conservative. And as a matter of fact, it looks like they're even going to be more zealous in holding the line on the budget. So rather than recount the specifics of which you could get in any of the establishment press, what I'd like to do tonight is talk about some of the unspoken givens. You needed to read between the lines to understand what was happening in the State of the Union message. For the most part, the higher circles have been talking about that America and the Western world faces a new era of limits, an era of constraints, as one White House aide put it. But President Carter chose in his State of the Union message not to emphasize that. For the most part, the tagline that he used was a new foundation. He used that several times in the speech. Rather, it should have been called the new austerity. That, of course, would not have the ring for a Democratic president of a party that is supposed to be the advocate of the common man. It doesn't have the it certainly doesn't have the ring of populism that a New Deal and Fair Deal. And essentially, what it is a raw deal.
Well, this is something they've been warning us about in the business press for quite a while, and in the Trilateral Commission publications, is it not?
Exactly. This has a long history to it. For those just coming on the scene, perhaps is not attentive to these sorts of matters. As a matter of fact, even if you are attentive, you wouldn't have heard about it through the establishment media. But the business press has always been less concerned about PR. They've often very, very candid about what the machinations that they have, they're thinking up, and what they would like to see the government do. This whole attack on the budget that we see, and this whole new austerity, is something that goes all the way back to a Fortune magazine article that appeared in 1972 that talked about the runaway federal budget. Even then, businessmen were talking about the fact that government was siphoning off too much, in the way of corporate taxes, a lot of the productive capital that they felt could go into the productive sector of the economy to generate profits, etc. And they talked about the need, really, to create a whole new world economic order, and that would require that Americans learn to do with less. Now, President Carter, of course, doesn't speak in such blunt terms. Not the kind of blunt terms that you would have, if you had been reading the Business Week in 1975, you would have heard. This I want you to pay special attention to, and I'm going to, if I may, I'd like to quote from Business Week in 1975. Some people will obviously have to do with less. Indeed, cities and states, the home mortgage market, small business, and the consumer will all get less than they want, because the basic health of the U.S. is based on the health of its corporations and banks. Yet it will be a hard pill for many Americans to swallow, the idea of doing with less so that big business can have more. It will be particularly hard to swallow because it is quite obvious that if big business and big banks are the most visible victims of what ails the debt economy, they also are in large measure the causes of it. Here, Business Week even mentions that if they are the causes of the debt economy. Nothing that this nation or any nation has done in modern history compares in the difficulty with the selling job that must be done to make the people accept the new reality. Let me mention that last line again. Nothing that this nation or any nation has done in modern history compares in difficulty with the selling job that must be done to make people accept the new reality. What is that new reality? Well, we've talked about it here on Alternative Views. There'll be no new national health insurance. There'll be no new aid to the cities. No new initiatives coming out of Washington for the most part. The defense budget has gotten a nice healthy raise to a whopping $123 billion, all in the face of talking about inflation, etc. So what we're dealing with, essentially, is trying to explain why would President Carter, a Democratic president, with a coalition elected with a coalition of liberals and blacks and labor, something that he will need to keep in the fold in 1980 if he thinks about any re-election prospects, why would he literally engineer a recession, the same conduct which he accused his predecessor, President Ford, of doing? Well, he has very little choice. He has very little choice if you accept the logic of a market economy, the logic of capitalism. Because what's really going on is that while he talks about inflation and he talks about the plight of old ladies on fixed incomes, what he doesn't mention, however, is that the multinational squeeze that started going on last summer and fall. If you'll remember, the price of gold was going up. The value of the dollar was falling. American goods imported into this country, especially oil, the price was going up, or at least the oil sheiks were making a lot of noise that it would go up. So what happened was the multinationals Remember, multinationals, that's an interesting term, too. Because a multinational is that very thing. It has no allegiance to one country. Anyone knowing anything about a little history, a little piece of history in parenthesis, is that the multinationals, GM and others, worked for both sides during World War II. The GM built engines for the Luftwaffe, which did quite a nice job on some of our people in World War II.
They continued building trucks and all, and their subsidiaries up until through 1943 for the Germans.
Exactly. Well, the multinationals don't have any allegiance to the United States, although they expect the American people to underwrite the military machine, which keeps access to its markets and et cetera in third world countries. So what they did is they basically said to Carter, and they said to the other state managers in Western Europe, is that if you expect us to continue to invest in your countries, you're going to have to be much more lean in your budgets. You're going to essentially have to crack the whip on the working class. Because if you read the business publications, they felt that the 1960s, the natives started getting a little restless. You had the civil rights movements, you had the anti-war movement, you had the ecology movement, the nuclear power movement, and what they were saying is, well, you know, they're rattling their cages a little bit too much. They expect a little too much in social services. What we're going to have to do is they're going to have to expect much less. And Carter, if he, being a capitalist, being a believer in the free enterprise system, was put in a squeeze, and as the Democratic Party is now. If you look for any kind of solace to liberals, you'll see that liberals, beleaguered as they are abandoning the Great Society programs, the legacy of the New Deal, and are themselves becoming great advocates of fiscal responsibility.
Jack, I might point out here that in carrying out this business, multinational, trilateral policy of austerity and tightening your belts, Carter is totally contradicting his campaign promises and the traditional Democratic sort of New Deal progressive social programs. In fact, it's interesting in regard to your analysis of Carter's budget and his State of the Union message that Jack Newfield, in a Village Voice article this week, made the case against Jimmy Lyer. What he did was to quote Carter's campaign speech in Madison Square Garden to the Democratic Convention with what he's actually done in recent days. This, let me give two quotes here to show the lies. Carter says we should make our major investment in people, not in weapons. But in the new budget, he's already said that he would increase defense spending 3% above the rate of inflation.
That's
and
correct.
I think it's gone up something like 10%, one of the largest raises in the defense budget in years, while cutting the school and lunch program. In fact, in relation to the defense budget, there was another interesting fact that the Village Voice printed from a speech of Elizabeth Holtzman of the House of Representatives, a congresswoman whose speech wasn't reported at all in the media. Holtzman found out that by the end of 1979, there was $47 billion in unspent money in federal departments, which included $21 billion in unspent funds in the defense budget from last year. That means that the moguls in the Pentagon were not able to spend $21 billion of the astronomical budget. Rather than cutting the budget this year and using some of that surplus from last year, they keep that in the background, and again, they get a tremendous new budget. This again shows Carter's lies that he is committed to incredibly high military spending and not to people. Just one more example. Carter promised that the aged must be treated with respect and compassion, with love, and now he reduces Social Security benefits, including disability payments, and he promised a complete overhaul of the tax system and calls it a disgrace to the human race. He said, all my life I've heard promises of tax reforms, but it never quite happens. I'm going to make it happen. And as we analyzed earlier, the tax reform really went to big business. Anyway, there's something like 10 other lies in Carter's speech that Jack Newfield analyzes by quoting what his campaign promises were and what he's actually done now. And I think you've really gotten the heart of it, that what Carter has done is to carry out this trilateral program and to sacrifice the traditional liberal democratic social programs.
There are a few other small things he's done just recently. He's postponed the strip mining rules because they'd work a hardship on business. He's excused Chrysler from the gas mileage requirements because that would work a hardship on Chrysler. He's raised the allowable smog level 50%, and eliminated over 1,000 of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration standards. Those are small things.
Well, that's exactly what, essentially, what the scenario we look for in the future. And instead of that kind of pep talk we got last night, called the State of the Union sound, what he actually should have been doing is actually speaking, if he is going to be going to carry out the plans of the multinationals, he ought to be talking squarely to the American people about the great sacrifices they're going to have to be made. To do that, though, would have really drawn into sharp focus exactly what the values of this system are. The values of this system where the goals of education and dignity and jobs and a clean environment will have to be sacrificed to profit. That's ultimately what we're talking about here. We're talking about a system for production and profit rather than for human need. And it's to draw those things into sharp focus that I think that Jimmy Carter and the rest of his crowd are unwilling to do and unwilling to speak straight to the American people.
Speaking of profit and all, Al, you've got something on this continuing struggle with McGraw-Hill, do you not?
I hate to bring down a level of conversation. We have a rather interesting catfight going on Wall Street right now. If you remember last week, we brought to you the news story about McGraw-Hill's attempts to fight off a takeover bid by American Express. We mentioned at the time that Roger Morley, who was president of American Express in January of 77, I believe, was brought in as a director of McGraw-Hill. And now American Express is trying to take over McGraw-Hill, and McGraw-Hill is screaming foul. To make matters more interesting, McGraw-Hill has taken on a two-page ad in the Wall Street Journal. And to do the language of the ad justice, I will read here from a section of this. A reply to unconscionable action. If you didn't know better, you'd think somebody was out poisoning animals. The independence and credibility of McGraw-Hill is vital to fulfilling its responsibilities to investors, the academic and educational and scientific communities, as well as those who rely on information and advisory services as well. It would be improper, inappropriate, and in direct violation of this responsibility to entrust McGraw-Hill's sensitive public interest activities, including Business Week, Standard & Poor's Credit Rating Services, to a company that pays virtually no federal income taxes on its hundreds of millions of dollars of annual income, operates in a manner that raises serious questions under the banking and securities laws, and pays no interest on billions of dollars it derives from the issuance of traveler's checks to the public. One dramatic illustration of the potential for serious conflicts of interest is the fact that, as a major investor in securities, American Express holds more than $3 billion in state and municipal securities and underwrites and insures additional state and municipal securities, securities that must be independently rated by McGraw and Hill's Standard & Poor's division. The background and manner of your proposal demonstrates that American Express lacks the integrity, corporate morality, and sensitivity to professional responsibility essential to McGraw-Hill's publishing, broadcasting, and credit rating services relied upon by so many people. Frankly, this surprises us. Such insensitivity and disregard of integrity and corporate morality is inconsistent with the reputation many American Express directors have enjoyed over the years. Perhaps it can be explained as impulsive, precipitous, immature actions taken by the younger members of the management before the more experienced members of your board had ample opportunity to fully consider the reckless proposal and its implications to each company. Well, to make matters a little bit more spicy, we bring in Morgan Guaranty and Trust Company. McGraw-Hill has banked at Morgan Guaranty and Trust Company for well over 50 years. Morgan Guaranty and Trust Company is the chief stockholder in American Express. American Express obtained financing for the merger from none other than Morgan Guaranty and Trust Company, which stands to make $125,000 if it fails and about $250,000 if it goes through. To counteract this, McGraw-Hill has hired one of the old spinoffs of Morgan Guaranty and Trust, Morgan Stanley and Company, to evaluate the proposal.
It's very incestuous, isn't it?
Well, it goes on. Now, American Express has sued McGraw-Hill because of this ad, which they claim to be libelous. They've sued McGraw-Hill and Harold W. McGraw, and let me quote, "McGraw has torturously and maliciously interfered with the prospective business advantage of an American Express offer." I'm not quite sure I know what that means. They claim that McGraw-Hill, among other things, lied about the fact that Morgan was its principal bank. even though Morgan's spokesman said at least a day or two before the suit that, yes, indeed, McGraw had banked there for well over 50 years. The question you have to ask yourself is, why did McGraw-Hill allow the president of American Express to become a director of McGraw-Hill, since American Express has a very active record in the merger market? It's kind of like opening up your gates, the city, to Attila the Hun, and then getting real upset when he ravishes and pillages your women in your city.
I think what's...
This has been going on for about 4 or 5 days, suits and countersuits and more suits.
What is interesting about this is that you can see the anatomy of the business system really at work, and a lot of things that are covered up by PR people and by academics, et cetera, who believe the various myths, they're brought out in the open and the raw, and you can actually see them take place, and it's interesting.
Well, the cutthroat competition, I think, is pretty vicious here.
Yeah. I have a little quote here to end our news portion of Alternative Views. This comes from the book Ethics and Profits, The Crisis of Confidence in American Business. And boy, if you want to read what the business people really think about you and me and the economy, read this book, because this gives the opinions, quotations from businessmen who got together in a secret conference and really spilled their guts and opened their hearts to the people who wrote the book. And it's shocking. For instance, here was one, our quote, "A representative democracy has never worked in the history of the world, and we are seeing that here in the United States. Autocracy has always followed democracy." Well, that's what the Trilateral Commissioner is saying, it's what the historian is saying, that's where we're going.
That's what Adolf Hitler was saying, too.
That's right. Well, how about our special part of our program?
Okay. Chris, do you want to begin with a discussion of Vietnam? Tell us about your trip, what you saw there. We'll interrupt you with questions.
Okay. I'd like to go ahead and show a few slides that I took there. I took a large number, and we have a few of them here today. These were taken in Hanoi primarily, and then in Ho Chi Minh City, which is formerly known as Saigon. Let me go ahead and start with the first one here.
Oops, that's the second one. What was the first one?
Well, the first one, which we just missed, was a picture of a building near the airport.
We got it. It's okay. It's the airport?
It's the old airport that's been ruined by the war, as you can see. An interesting thing about this picture is on the left is a bomb crater. The bomb craters are a large number of bomb craters in the country that... obviously, it's difficult to fill them in because they were created and the land was impacted, and there's nothing you can do about it. However, you can do a lot about the destroyed buildings. For instance, this whole street, Cam Tien Street in Hanoi, was totally destroyed during the war, and a memorial was built to it. And now, as you can see, the whole street has been rebuilt. That was one of the interesting things, was to be able to, not to see much destruction in evidence. Psychologically, there's been a great deal, and medically, but the tremendous progress that has been made in the past 3 years is really astounding. These are other street scenes in Hanoi. For instance, what's interesting here is you see a woman hauling a very large pile of something. We're not sure what it is, but we go on and see other shots. We see that women are some of the primary workers. Women make up about 1% of the population and 60% of the workforce. We go on here and we see women selling fruit on the marketplace in Hanoi. I could go into a whole description of the economy, which perhaps we can talk about a little bit later.
Okay.
You can buy, food is rationed. Everything is rationed. Food is the major problem in Vietnam today, which is why the wheat shipment took place.
What about the prices? Is there inflation, or are the prices under control?
The plot prices are all under control. They're all determined by the state, except for that which is on the free market. However, that free market is another word for black market. Ever since the transformation of the economy, however, the free market plot prices have come down. So people still are able to buy in the free market. It is right out in the open. This is a picture taken in Reunification Park in Hanoi, and typifies some of the new attitude that is characteristic of the whole country. We were quite taken with the beautiful sculpture and the happy faces in Reunification Park. And if you look closely, you can see the elephants.
Oh, those are elephants.
Made out of shrubbery in the background, which is quite clever. Ho Chi Minh exercises are being done here at 5:30 in the morning by the women outside our hotel, all over North Vietnam in particular, and probably in other parts of Vietnam now. People do the Ho Chi Minh exercises, and since the sun came up very early, I tried to do them along with them at one point. The Hanoi Circus is quite a sight on Saturday night. It's a one-ring circus, and we enjoyed seeing that. It cost about one dong. That's equivalent to about 25, 30 cents. The National Assembly building in Hanoi is the place where the government meets, and the representatives from the various parties. Of course, the Communist Party is the primary party in Vietnam, but other representatives are there from the Buddhist groups and even from some of the Christian groups.
What about South Vietnam? Do they have
Well, of course, yes. It's all one country now, of course, and so there are representatives from all over the country. This is the Ho Chi Minh Mausoleum. And every day, starting very early in the morning, thousands of people line up to see the remains of Ho Chi Minh. He is still lying in state there. I had never seen a preserved body like this before. It's very fascinating.
Lenin's is preserved in Red Square. That's the model of it.
It's the same type of thing. Bach Mai Hospital is the largest teaching facility in Southeast Asia, and one which many people have heard about for many years. It was bombed three times during the war, the last one being in December of 1972.
Mm-hmm. The infamous Christmas mob bombing of Nixon.
Yeah. Right.
Christmas present.
This is a woman on a heart-lung machine within the hospital. These machines were donated by the Bach Mai Hospital Fund. However, as we went through the hospital, we asked to see or find out which parts from the machines were missing, because some of the machines they couldn't even use because they couldn't get the parts, so we hope to be able to replace some of those parts. And of course, outside the hospital is the memorial to the bombing of the hospital, and this is one place where a large segment of the hospital remains. 95% of North Vietnam is collectivized, and this is a collective farm near Hanoi. About 8,000, 9,000 people are related to this farm, and this seems to be a very effective way of operating.
Excuse me, how is wages determined in Vietnam?
Right now, wages are determined by the state. The wages are very low, approximately 120 dong a month. That would be approximately $40, and that could go for a university professor or for a worker. There is some differentiation in wages. Some people do get more wages, higher than others. But for instance, the cadre that were with us on our trip, who were members of a non-governmental committee actually, but they were dressed very simply, and so that there is a unification of and a standardization of the wages.
Chris, is the agriculture in South Vietnam also collectivized? Have they begun to establish collective farms there also?
Yes, they've begun to do that, and particularly with the new economic zones in the south. There are 350 of them, and they're mostly collective farms, and they have what they call mutual exchange farms. That's one level they start with, and then they move to collective farms and cooperatives after that. And they just haven't gotten to the level that they have in North Vietnam at this point.
Are there still small family farms left?
Very few. They have been very gradual in getting or promoting the collectivization in the south, because they were very sensitive to the people and the needs of the people. However, already in the north, of course, it was, as I said, 95% collectivized, and the 5% remaining was mainly in the minorities in the north, in the mountain areas.
What portion of the population are involved in agriculture? One of the criticisms of in China has been that too great a portion of the population had to be involved in just straight agricultural production, not freeing them to do other things. How about in Vietnam?
I don't really have a figure on that. However, I do know that there's a large number, because a lot of people who were re-educated, quote unquote. I mean, like ex-army officers and civilians were then sent to new economic zones and are farming now. However, those people who had businesses were not moved. They were able to continue on in their businesses, so it hasn't been like a mass changeover like it has in some of the other countries.
How do they seem to be working, the collective farms in South Vietnam? Were the people happy? Were they accepting the changes in their life? Could you tell
them? They were accepting of it. Let's face it, it's not an easy life. And when we talked to one ex-army officer who was living on a collective farm in a new economic zone, why, he said, you know, it's not an easy life, but at least we have a house. They're given a free house to live in, and a well and a small garden themselves, and so it's better than not having anything to eat. And so they're accepting of that. And the people we talk to, I wouldn't say that they're exuberant, because life is very difficult. However, they are there's been tremendous progress, and people who weren't eating before are eating now.
Well, what's your next slide?
Okay. We go down to Ho Chi Minh City now, and this is one of the rivers of the Mekong. Looking from our hotel window, you could see this view, and this is the river that our Antioquia, the wheat shipment, came in here.
May I ask you a quick question about that? Aren't they primarily rice eaters over in that part of the world? Is wheat really part of their diet, or why wheat?
Well, wheat was the commodity that was easily obtainable. They do eat a lot of wheat in the South, primarily due to the French influence.
Oh, okay.
They have French bread, which is delicious. They also have noodles, which we ate and enjoyed. So they're appreciative of what they can get, because food is very hard to come by.
So mostly a vegetarian population?
They eat a lot of fish and some pork in their menu. For instance, we ate Vietnamese food, and we had a lot of fish and pork and chicken.
What was the attitude of the Vietnamese towards receipt of the wheat? Are they unhappy that it's viewed as charity, they can't take care of themselves, or they want more wheat shipments?
Well, from what we could see, they were very happy to receive the wheat. This, you could say, well, this was an official endorsement, but there was a very large celebration. We all went down to meet the boat. There was a big celebration in a local hotel. This was filmed on television and shown all over Vietnam. Mm-hmm. People would come up to us and speak to us about it. So there didn't seem to be any obvious resentment to it. They were very appreciative of it.
Isn't part of the problem that there were floods in the Mekong Delta and 3 million tons of rice paddies were destroyed?
Yes.
That's the account I just read today.
Are these man-made, U.S.-made floods, or these natural floods?
I don't know. There was an analysis that I read a couple years ago that the ecology was badly destroyed in Vietnam, and it might be part of the problem of their floods. Do you have some information on that?
I really don't have any information on that right now. However, I do know there were large floods taking place just recently. And then before we went, there had been a drought belt across that whole area, which is one of the reasons that Church World Service made the shipment of wheat. But then there's also been typhoons, and so they just had a series of natural disasters, plus all the defoliation that had taken place during the war, and half of the cultivatable land had been destroyed during the war. So this all adds to
I think there were more bombs dropped on Vietnam than had been dropped anywhere or everywhere in history before. The sum total is phenomenal. I saw once of figures, and it was astounding.
Yes, I think that's probably true.
Okay, what's next?
Okay, let's see what we have here. This is a picture of a redignification center in the south, in Ho Chi Minh City, a center where they retrain ex-prostitutes so that they can learn a profession, they're cured of their disease, and they're educated into socialist ideology. This is a very interesting place to visit. There are about three of these places in the country of Vietnam. An orphanage. One could go into many orphanages in Vietnam and see children of all backgrounds.
Mainly children of U.S. servicemen.
Well, there were, yes, there were children of servicemen, you could tell that also, but many other orphans were there also as well. You couldn't always pick them out that long. All right. This is a new economic zone, Pham Van Gogh, that we visited. And here they were farming primarily sorghum and peanuts and rice. The workers here were thinning the sorghum on their hands and feet. And one of the problems that they had was continually coming across shrapnel on the land. This particular new economic zone had been completely defoliated at one time, and so the soil was very hard to work with. And they had to spend 25% of their time demining the place. Of course, this was established in 77. We were there in 78, so it was in better condition at that time. This was some of the equipment that they did use to reclaim the land.
And the new economic zones are relocation centers of former South Vietnamese officers and high government officials.
Yes, that, and also 700,000 people have been moved from Ho Chi Minh City to these new economic zones, so that there are no longer beggars on the streets, for instance, in Ho Chi Minh City.
How do you compare that the experience in Vietnam with the bloody transition that we saw in Kampuchea? In terms of what happens to people who just don't go along with the new order? What happens in Vietnam?
Well, they don't encourage dissent, of course.
Of course.
The official policy, they allow people to disagree, but
yes.
They don't officially go along with it. It's nothing like, there was no bloodbath. That was the thing that really strikes you. There was no bloodbath in those 3 years, as had been predicted by President Ford. People were re-educated in a reconciling way. They wanted to re-educate them to the new economy. So they didn't want to kill anybody. Nobody was killed, as a matter of fact. I guess one person who led an insurrection was tried and killed.
Are there jails in Vietnam?
As far as I know, there are. I didn't ask that much about that, but there are places where people are detained, I think. But I don't know for sure.
Would they qualify as political prisoners? Or your petty thievery and et cetera?
Here again, I don't have the details about that, and that's something that I'd like to find out more about.
Yeah, but since then, you've had that vast exodus of people, the boat people, too. So.
Yes.
Haven't they been mainly of Chinese origin?
My impression is that originally they were not, that most were opponents of the regime, people who were disgruntled with the regime, who did not care to live under the communists. And that more recently, though, it's been many ethnic Chinese who have been discriminated or feel that they've been discriminated by new Vietnamese authorities and who feel that they have no future in China or in Vietnam and have been fleeing. So.
Have these been much of a merchant class that used to exist in the South?
There seems to have been very large Chinese merchant class in Saigon. My impression is that much of the trade in Saigon was concentrated in the hands of the ethnic Chinese, and that this was a source of resentment among native Vietnamese towards the Chinese, and the upshot of which is, of course, that now that the Vietnamese have control of their own country, that they've taken out their hostility on the Chinese, and then the Chinese, having no place to go, have fled.
That's a historical antipathy, is it not?
There's a long history of Chinese and Vietnamese antipathy, yes.
Ed, how does this compare with what happened in China? I've heard two radically different accounts of the problem of socialization in China and how they dealt with dissent. The first account, which I take it as something of a myth, was that there was few political prisons, there was little torture, there was no murder, etc. And then recently, I think, is it Simon Lace has written a book who has tremendously gruesome accounts of some of the torture and some of the horrendous things that the Chinese supposedly did to dissidents. What is your information on this issue?
Well, I don't know that Lays is the one that really lays it out about the Chinese tortures and prisons. He has many other criticisms to make about the regime, but that is really not one of them, although he does talk about overall oppression of dissidents. when the communists first came to power in 1949, many dissidents were killed, and many of them fled, of course, to other countries. And those who did not flee, many of them were killed, particularly in the course of land reform, which was very, very bloody. The Chinese were at that time engaged in a war with the United States and Korea, the Korean War, and the Chinese really felt threatened at that time, and they felt that there were many internal enemies to the regime within China. And in many cases, there had been also a lot of built-up hostility among the peasants towards, say, landlords and so forth. And so in the early years, say from 1949 to, say, 1952, 53 maybe, large numbers of Chinese counter-revolutionaries from the standpoint of the new regime were killed. But since that time, there has not been any large-scale repression. There are jails in China, there are labor camps, you get many horror stories actually coming out now under the new leadership of Deng Xiaoping, that the Gang of Four, who supposedly dominated China from the late 60s down to 1975, 76, that they were very vengeful towards their enemies, drove many people to suicides, punished many people by unjustly imprisoning them and so forth. So it's very clear, even from their own sources, that the revolution, ongoing revolution, is by no means a peaceful one. There is a lot of bloodshed, a lot of repression. But they, of course, justify in terms of the social good that comes from the small minority of people who would otherwise cause trouble to the revolution.
What's the situation now that the China is letting the multinational corporations in and the banks in, and it looks like they're asking to become a third world country at the hands of imperialism, economic imperialism again?
Well, they don't want to be a third world country. They want to be a second or first world country, because their aim is to modernize by the end of the century. This is the aim that goes back to Zhou Enlai. And I think that if Mao Zedong were alive, conceivably he would support it, because in the past, in the 1950s, he has supported such a campaign of rapid modernization. But the Chinese are very aware that they are a backward country, that it's a poor country, and they want to modernize and to raise a standard of living. In order to do this, they realize that they have to borrow the advanced technology of the West. And this advanced technology is often in the hands of the multinationals. And they're willing, I think, to take the risk. They have bought complete plants from foreign corporations, with the idea that the foreign corporations would teach the Chinese how to run these plants, and then the Chinese would take over, and hopefully then the Chinese would be able to cut their umbilical cords with the multinationals. So I think they're conscious of the strings that come attached to these projects, and I think they are trying to counteract this.
Well, how do they know they can do it? It's never been done before. They've never been able, no country has been able to do that. What makes them think that they would be able to do this where nobody else has been successful at it? Or do you have...
Well, I don't know why they think they may be able to do it. I don't know how conscious they are, say, of the experience of other countries in the hands of the multinationals. I think they must be conscious of it, because this is a question of internal debate. Even up until a year ago, they said that the Chinese leadership said that they were unwilling to mortgage their future in order to acquire the advanced technology. And in the last year, they've changed this position. They are now willing to mortgage their future.
What safeguards do they have to assure that a multinational that invests over there and begins to build a factory won't pull out? I know they have 51% control, but what other sorts of controls do they have?
I don't know, because I don't know what's written in the contracts.
Mm-hmm. Are they secret? Are these things not generally known to the public?
I've never seen any contract published. Actually, up until very recently, American companies doing business with the Chinese have been very secretive.
Mm-hmm.
It's only in the last month or so that they really have come out into the open and talk publicly about their activities in China.
Chris, did you get any evidence in Vietnam that similar things were going on there? Were they interested in having American corporations coming over and building? Did you see any
Well, we saw a lot of, there were Swedes there but building a paper plant. There was a Scottish consortium there negotiating to come in. I don't know that much about, they're interested in trade, for instance, with the United States, but there's no normalization of relations, so nothing like that could really take place with Americans.
We did see several weeks ago where they have asked American oil companies to come in and take a look and see what could be done there, they're exploiting their resources. As a matter of fact, remember during the Vietnam War, there were reports that one of the major concerns of the United States was to try to retain control of Vietnam so they could exploit the supposedly large oil resources that are there. Of course, after the war's over, they find they can get it anyway without fighting.
Well, they also found out the sources weren't as vast as they thought at one point. They tended to be rumors.
But the Chinese sources seem to be extremely large.
That's right. That's
and
right.
It's just further on down south, so maybe they are.
That's one of the issues in contention between Vietnam and China is ownership of the offshore oil in the Gulf of Tonkin. I don't know what the resolution of that is. I don't think it has been resolved, but it is an ongoing problem.
Chris, did you have any more slides before we got into the Cambodia-Vietnam issue?
Well, we have some of Cambodia on the border, as a matter of fact.
Right. Yes. So why don't you finish your slides, and then we'll go into the Cambodia issue.
Okay. This is Swen Lock, which is an education center which has been closed and is now housing Cambodian detainees, as they were called at that time. They weren't called POWs. The sign above the building says, "Nothing is more precious than independence and freedom," a sign which you see, a quote from Ho Chi Minh, you see at many places in the country. Moving on to the Cambodian border, this is in Anjan province, a place called Chau Dak, a place we visited that had recently had shelling by the Cambodians. And here again you see the saying above Ho Chi Minh's picture, the one that I just quoted, and his picture.
Is that facing the Cambodian border? Let them know who's boss? Or
I'm not sure about that. I'll just show about three shots here of places that were shelled.
By the Cambodians?
Shelled by the Cambodians. This last one is a school that we went through, and several school children were killed, and school had to be closed down, and they built tunnels so that if this should ever happen again, why, there'd be a place for them to go.
How close to the border is this?
This is very close to the border, like right on about 5 miles, I'd say, from the border. And this is right on the border. Driving up along the border, we saw where there have been like at least 200,000 Vietnamese had to flee for their homes along the border, and houses were shelled and evacuated like this one here.
This is their official explanation of why they had to invade Cambodia, that it was survival, that they were literally for 2 years getting shelled along this region. All these people had to flee. It was destroying their very delicate economic balance, and they were afraid of even worse invasions, so they needed to counterattack.
Yes.
Is that the line they were giving you at that time?
Yes, and we saw evidences of it. I mean, we saw pictures of atrocities that had been committed, and this picture that was on right here was a picture of people, the wounded peasants in the hospitals. I mean, the spot that we left was shelled 5 minutes after we left it, so that was a close call.
They also claim that the Cambodians at this time refused to negotiate completely, that they just wouldn't talk about the issue. And there was also a factor that in these times analysis by Gareth Porter, who just came back here this week, that China withdrew its aid program to Vietnam in May of 1978, which I take it was when you were there. And that this made the Vietnamese very paranoid. They saw the Chinese siding with Cambodia, and this gave them some indication that China was now their enemy and that they had to take action against Cambodia to maintain their independence. When you were there in 78, did you get any sense of problems with China?
Yes, this was mentioned when we discussed with some high government officials. as to why this was taking place. One of the reasons that was given, even though they said they didn't really know or understand why it was taking place, was that they felt that possibly China was behind the invasions by Cambodia. And of course, it was at that time that the Chinese were leaving because of the social transformation of the economy. I have a slightly different interpretation of that exodus, by the way.
What is your interpretation?
The official position given when we were there at that time was that they were free to leave if they wanted to, because the inventory had taken place of all the goods that people had. And for instance, one man was found to have 10,000 Hondas, and they had to sell these goods and put the money in the bank or else invest them into joint enterprises with the government. I'm not saying that there wasn't pressure on some Chinese to leave. I think that certainly is a possibility, but at the same time, the official position was that they were free to leave if they wanted to.
You have some picture of some Cambodian refugees too, do you?
Yes, I have a picture of the Ben San refugee camp, which had approximately 9,000 Cambodian refugees. There are about 100,000 of them had come across the border at that point into Vietnam.
And this is the final reason the Vietnamese supposedly decided to invade Cambodia, is that there were so many refugees pulling out of the country, and they had intelligence that there was tremendous resistance within the country that would serve as part of an uprising against the Pol Pot regime, and that therefore they had fairly clear assurances of success and it would be in the interests of the people.
Yes, I feel that those are very important factors in the recent events with Cambodia.
Say, looking at that slide, it looks like the Cambodians, I don't know if this is representative of Cambodians, but they look quite different from the Vietnamese.
Yes, they do have different facial characteristics. You can tell from the pictures. I have one more picture of the homes that were being built by the Vietnamese for the Cambodians. Actually, the people in that province had to give of their own rationing, and the government was supplying, and also the UN came in to help out with the refugees. But they were fairly nice houses that were being built for the refugees. They were really treating them humanely. And my last shot is going back to Ho Chi Minh City, and we have to end with the sunset on the Mekong River in Ho Chi Minh City.
That reminds me of that old Spike Jones record, as the sun pulls away from the shore and our boat sinks slowly in the west. Well, what about the Vietnamese, the Cambodian situation? That's really rather curious, strange.
It's strange. In these times, while giving this very detailed analysis of why Vietnam did invade Cambodia, which evidently Chris seems to go along with from her own experiences there, says, nonetheless, a socialist country is not justified in invading another socialist country, and that this raises questions for the first time in history about the proper relationships between socialist states in a very dramatic way. And so I think we're going to have a whole lot of different issues within the world socialist movement after this. Of course, the Soviet Union had invaded Czechoslovakia and Hungary before, but that's a somewhat different situation, I think, than actual warfare between two socialist states. What seems to be the situation now in Cambodia, from the evidence that people have, is the new regime genuinely representative of the Cambodian people? Will the Vietnamese withdraw? Is there any trends at this point?
I'm not sure that I know specifically now what's going. I mean, I know that the Kampuchea National Front for National Salvation, as it is called, which I read.
It's a mouthful.
It's a mouthful. It's very hard to remember also. Claims that they're going to do a large number of humanitarian things, and I would certainly support that. I don't. There's the article that I read about it said there was no independent observer on the spot, so that you can't really know precisely. You simply get interpretations from Thailand and from Hanoi.
What about the interpretations that Kampuchea was a client state of China, and that Russia had the Vietnamese in their palm, and it's a bigger struggle than that? You hear that so frequently. Is there really any value to that?
Well, I gather there are really two interpretations of the Vietnam-Cambodia struggle. One is to see it as part of a global struggle, as you said, between the Soviet Union and China, with Vietnam as the pawn of the Soviet and Cambodia as the pawn of the Chinese, and that this is a proxy war. And then there's the other interpretation, which I tend to subscribe to, which sees this basically as a regional conflict between the Vietnam and Cambodia, with China and Soviet Union playing basically a subsidiary role. I think this is a case where maybe traditional hostilities, ethnic hostilities, is rising to triumph over socialism. That in the past several centuries there has been a great deal of mutual hostility between the Vietnamese and the Cambodians. The Cambodians, in particular, fearing Vietnamese expansion, which God knows they have perfect right to fear, in the light of what has happened recently. And the Vietnamese, on the other hand, looking down on the Cambodians as somewhat inferior to themselves. And I don't know whether Chris had any evidence of this or saw any evidence of this, but. At any rate, my reading is that the Vietnamese basically want to have designs no further than, say, Cambodia and Laos, and that they have that this invasion of Cambodia is in a way the Vietnamese marching into an area that the Vietnamese always feel as their own, almost as only their own territory, their own backyard. The Cambodians, on the other hand, it's clear, do not share the Vietnamese view of this conflict. And Sihanouk has said very clearly that while he disagreed with the policies of the Pol Pot regime, and in fact he was imprisoned by Pol Pot, that he supported Pol Pot in Cambodia against the Vietnamese. So I'm not sure that the Vietnamese are going to be able to pull it off if the Cambodians resort to guerrilla warfare or some sort of opposition to the Vietnamese.
And while we have you here, could I ask you a question on this issue of modernization? I would have thought that if the Cultural Revolution had woven itself into the fabric of Chinese society, that there would be more resentment about this modernization going on, especially the stratification, hierarchy, material incentive returning, etc. Can you speak? Was the Gang of Four just an isolated, with having no popular base, or was there a great deal of internal power structures in China going on at the time? I know that's two separate questions. Mm-hmm. One question is, was the transition from Mao Zedong's death to the new leaders as smooth as we would think? And two, on this issue of modernization, I think they're related.
Well, the transition was not smooth in the sense that it did involve almost a military coup by Hua Guofeng and Deng Xiaoping against the Gang of Four, but it was relatively bloodless. Uh-huh. I think the question really it comes down to was the Cultural Revolution as popular as it was portrayed back uh-huh. in the late 60s and early 70s, and I don't know. I'm sure there is a lot of opposition right now among many people to the going back on many of the values of the Cultural Revolution. How many people there are, whether they represent a majority, I don't know. I suspect that right now that the majority of the Chinese people support the present campaign of modernization, and I suspect that back during the Cultural Revolution that it was supported by only a minority of the people. And that probably the arrest of the Gang of Four was, in fact, a popular action.
Okay, that's about all the time we have tonight.
We're sorry. Maybe we can have you back for another conversation. I'd like to thank both of our guests. This was a fascinating inside look at Vietnam, an extremely interesting discussion of the events in China, Vietnam, and Cambodia. Next week, we're going to turn to an in-depth special in Iran. So good night.
Oh, wait a minute. Well, I got a bedtime story.
Okay.
Very quick bedtime story. It also comes from this book, Ethics and Profits. One of the things that the businessmen were complaining about was the raw deal they got in the press. So one of the businessmen irately turned to a publisher, a newspaper, and said, "Why don't you tell the truth about us?" The publisher said, "If I did tell the public everything we know about you, they would like you even less."
Amen.
Good night.
Good night. I thought we had several more minutes for China.